Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, May 21st, 2021. I'm your reader, Lee Dwyer, and we'll start with some local news from the Cedar Rapids Gazette. The man charged with killing University of Iowa student Molly Tibbetts in 2018 led investigators to her body and said he killed her, but couldn't remember how, an officer testified Thursday. Christian Bahena Rivera initially denied he had ever seen Tibbetts when he was interrogated a month after her disappearance from her hometown of Brooklyn, Iowa, Officer Pamela Romero testified. Bahena Rivera eventually admitted that he had driven past Tibbetts three times while she was out for a run on July 18, 2018, describing her as attractive and hot, Romero said. Within hours, Bahena Rivera led investigators to the cornfield where they discovered Tibbetts' remains, she said. Pressed on what had happened to Tibbetts, Bahena Rivera responded, "I brought you here, didn't I? So that means that I did it. I don't remember how I did it," Romero testified he had told her. Romero testified Thursday on the second day of Bahena Rivera's first-degree murder trial at the Scott County Courthouse in Davenport as prosecutors used the partial confession and a surveillance video to build their case. Bahena Rivera, age 26, faces life in prison if convicted of the stabbing death, which inflamed anger over illegal immigration since he was a Mexican national living illegally in the United States. Bahena Rivera's defense worked to cast suspicion on others, including Tibbetts' boyfriend and residents who had been investigated because of their past behavior toward women. The defense attorneys are expected to argue that the confession was false and coerced after hours of interrogation. During questioning at the cornfield, Bahena Rivera told Romero that he followed Tibbetts in his car, got out, and started running behind her. Bahena Rivera said that Tibbetts noticed him and attempted to use her cell phone to call police. He said that Molly tried to slap him and was screaming at him, Romero testified. Mr. Rivera said that this is when he became angry. Bahena Rivera told Romero that he remembered the two started fighting, but then he blacked out. He said the next thing he recalled was driving in his car and seeing the earbuds Tibbetts used while running on his legs, and that her body was in his trunk, Romero testified. Bahena Rivera told Romero that he did not remember how she got in the vehicle, but that he recalled carrying her body on his shoulder to the cornfield, covering her with leaves, and leaving immediately. He said her body felt like a person that had just fainted and was bleeding, pointing to his neck when asked why. He said he had taken his shirt off that day because of the blood. Romero, then an Iowa City police officer, was brought in to question Bahena Rivera because, like him, she was a native of Mexico whose first language was Spanish. She recalled asking Bahena Rivera what he thought as his neighbors and scores of investigators had searched for Tibbetts. He just shrugged his shoulders, and he goes, "I didn't think about it," Romero said. Earlier Thursday, jurors were shown videos of a woman running and a vehicle later tied to Bahena Rivera driving by her seconds later that investigators called critical to solving the case. Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation Agent Derek Reisman testified he obtained the surveillance video from a homeowner on August 14, 2018 as part of a canvass of Brooklyn and began reviewing it with other agents. He said the next day another agent said he believed he saw something significant and Reisman thought he was kidding. Additional review showed a person appearing to run through the neighborhood in the distance, entering and leaving the video frame in a split second. Reisman said he determined it was a runner who appeared to have a ponytail and was passing at 7:45 p.m. About 20 seconds later, a black Chevy Malibu with distinctive chrome rims and door handles drove past. Reisman said the vehicle is seen on surveillance several times over the next 20 minutes, ultimately going back toward the direction of the runner at a higher rate of speed at 8:07 p.m. He said that Tibbetts, age 20, is suspected to have been abducted on a rural road about 2 miles away about 8:20 p.m. Reisman said neither the driver nor the license plate could be identified on the video. Poweshiek County Deputy Steve Kivy said he reviewed the video on August 15, 2018, after spending a month looking into what happened to Tibbetts, who was living in her hometown over a summer break. The next day, Kibbe said he spotted the vehicle outside of Brooklyn getting off Interstate 80 and followed the driver, who turned out to be Bahena Rivera. Kibbe said Bahena Rivera was cooperative during their discussion that day, calmly denying knowing anything about what happened to Tibbetts. Investigators testified that on August 20, 2018, they went to Yerrabee Farms, where Bahena was working in the milk parlor, to interview him and other employees. DCI agent Scott Green said he was directed by the lead investigator to collect DNA by swabbing the cheek of every worker, who were all Hispanic and numbered about 8. He said he wasn't sure why he wasn't asked to obtain DNA from the farm's white owner or others he interviewed previously in Brooklyn. Green said that Bahena Rivera agreed to come with him to the sheriff's office to be interviewed further and allowed investigators to search the Malibu, his nearby trailer, and another vehicle he had driven to work. Investigators acknowledged they never found a murder weapon. The trial, being held in Davenport on a change of venue, is expected to continue into next week. New Iowa law bans school mask mandates. Iowa districts scrambled on Thursday to comply with a new order banning mask mandates in schools that were passed in the final hours of the 2021 legislative session and signed into law by Governor Kim Reynolds just hours before the school day started. Cedar Rapids, Iowa City, and Lindmar school districts were among those that announced early Thursday they will abide by the new law and no longer require face coverings for students, staff, or visitors effective immediately. In an email to families, Cedar Rapids Community School District Superintendent Noreen Bush said the system is unclear yet if this applies to students and staff on school buses, as federal law requires masks on all public transportation vehicles, including buses. The district also apologized for the abrupt timing of the notice, which Bush said did not provide families any time to plan. The Lindmar and Iowa City Community School Districts were encouraging students and staff to continue wearing face coverings when in school buildings. While face coverings are no longer required, we strongly encourage families to have their students wear a face covering, especially if they have not received the COVID-19 vaccine. Superintendent Matt Degner said in an email to families, "We also recommend staff continue to wear face coverings while at work and social distancing is not possible. Bullying and harassment of individuals who choose whether or not to wear a face covering will not be tolerated." Most districts are completing their academic year over the next 2 weeks, and some had decided to keep their mask requirements in place for the remainder of the school year. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also recommends schools continue to use COVID-19 prevention strategies, including face masks, for the remainder of the 2020 through 2021 school year. Even so, the GOP governor hailed the last-minute legislation. "The state of Iowa is putting parents back in control of their children's education and taking greater steps to protect the rights of all Iowans and make their own health care decisions," she said in a statement. "I am proud to be a governor of a state that values personal responsibility and individual liberties. I want to thank the Iowa legislature for their quick work in bringing this bill to my desk so that it can be signed into law." The new law also prohibits city and county governments from enacting face mask requirements that exceed the state's face mask policy. Iowa currently has no statewide face mask requirement. Throughout the pandemic that started here in March of 2020, the state enacted a face mask rule only partially requiring their use from November 2020 through early February. Mayors in Coralville and Iowa City already had lifted their own local mask mandates. In Cedar Rapids, Mayor Brad Hart had eased the city's mask mandate to end the mask-wearing requirement for fully vaccinated individuals in most indoor and outdoor settings in line with modified CDC guidance. To comply with the new state law, Hart on Thursday lifted the city's mask mandate. Businesses may opt to require masks with their own locations. Some cities and counties are in a different place in fighting the pandemic, but the legislature and the governor do not see it that way, which to me is disappointing, Hart said on Thursday. "It should be a local control issue, but obviously we're going to comply with laws." Hart pointed to statements CDC Director Rochelle Walensky has made encouraging more local control over guidance on mask wearing. "We wanted to deliver the science of the individual level. But we also understand that these decisions have to be made at the community's level, Walensky said. This is just more politics over science, Senator Joe Bolcom, a Democrat of Iowa City, said Wednesday night as lawmakers debated the provision. Masks have saved lives. We should continue to let this decision be made by local officials. The measure was introduced in an amendment to House File 847 and passed both chambers on party-line votes, with Republicans supporting and Democrats opposing. COVID-19 activity has plummeted in Iowa since the deadly winter surge, but the virus is still spreading in the state and new variants continue to emerge. On Wednesday morning, another 233 new cases were recorded, according to Iowa Public Health data. The Food and Drug Administration earlier this month granted emergency approval for the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine to be administered to 12 to 15-year-olds. It previously was approved for people aged 16 and up. The other two vaccines available now, Moderna and Johnson & Johnson, are approved for those 18 and older only. So the percentage of school students who have been vaccinated remains small. One local doctor criticized the move Thursday, saying it could be disastrous for some families. Dr. Scott Now, a pediatrician at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids, said he already has received calls from parents of immunocompromised or otherwise higher-risk children requesting a doctor's note to pull their children out of school for the remainder of the year. Research has shown while healthy children are less likely to experience severe outcomes from a COVID-19 infection, they are still capable of spreading it. Now said he worries children could bring the virus home to older family members who could become severely ill or die. I don't think we'll see big outbreaks, but it puts social needs kids at risk, and it puts families with fragile health at risk, he said. It didn't need to happen. The new law comes on the heels of guidance issued earlier this week by the head of the state's public health department, Kelly Garcia, recommending school districts and child care centers treat COVID-19 like any other childhood illness, such as the flu. July 4th fireworks are returning to downtown Cedar Rapids. The Cedar Rapids Freedom Festival is coming back with a bang and a splash this summer, organized announced on Thursday. About the only things that happened in person last year in the iconic annual community celebration were the medallion hunt and the pancake breakfast, which flipped into a drive-through format outside the I'm on Ice Arena. They are returning, joined by several other signature events, building up to the July 4th finale fireworks downtown. The choreographed fireworks show, a victim of the pandemic last summer, is scheduled from 7 to 10:30 p.m. on July 4th. As before, the fireworks will be shot off from the First Avenue Bridge, and spectators with Freedom Festival buttons will be let onto the Second Avenue Bridge. However, capacity will be limited. Among the first events to fire up the festival will be the Balloon Glow, bringing a record 10 tethered hot air balloons on June 10th to Hawkeye Downs. Elizabeth Von Presley will rock the stage that night. Admission will be limited, with advance reservations requested. Details on ticket packages will be released beginning on Monday on the festival's website, freedomfestival.com. Dock Dogs, an aquatic competition perennially popular with pooches and people, will be pooling on the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library grounds from June 24th through the 27th. A walkthrough parade will follow the downtown farmers market footprint on June 26th. Before all that happens, intrepid detectives can comb the area for a prize medallion that comes with a $500 Hy-Vee gift card reward. The annual medallion hunt launches Monday and runs through June 2nd. The 4-inch acrylic disc with the festival logo will be hidden on public property. One clue per day will be revealed on the festival's Facebook page and website, freedomfestival.com, as well as on KCRG TV9 and Z102.9 radio. On June 14th and 15th, the public can watch as local artists gather at the Jones Park Lagoon Pavilion for a log carving demonstration, turning derecho wood remnants into works of art as the pieces are completed. They'll be added to an online silent auction fundraiser going online Monday at 32auctions.com/freedomfestival. The auction isn't the only online event. The Port Tornadoes will perform a virtual Music at the Museum concert July 3rd via Facebook. Other events will be offered online. Our goal this year is to provide the community a good mix of programming that reflects a safe return to live events, Carol Shepherd, the festival's executive director, said in a statement. We will have a mix of in-person programming, but also will incorporate some online components, where those that don't feel comfortable gathering can still experience the festival, she said, citing the Tribute to Heroes, Flag Retirement, and Balloon Glow among the online offerings. Freedom Festival buttons will go on sale May 28th for $5 at Cedar Rapids and Marion Hy-Vee food and drug stores, as well as Casey's General Stores. Use the Dietz app to unlock button benefits during the festival. Details on each event will be finalized in the coming weeks, Shepherd noted, and will follow guidelines and recommendations from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the City of Cedar Rapids, and Linn County Public Health. Mount Mercy names new president. Mount Mercy University has picked a new president, Todd Olson, current vice president for student affairs at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. Dr. Olson's commitment to students and passion for the Sister of Mercy's critical concerns align perfectly with our Mercy values and longstanding tradition of compassionate service, Charlie Rode, chairman of the Mount Mercy Board, said in a statement on Thursday. We are delighted to have Dr. Olson join our community, and we appreciate his deep experience in higher education administration. Olson will start his tenure at the Cedar Rapids-based Catholic University on July 21st, about 1 year after its last president started his short-lived tenure. Robert Beatty, who became Mount Mercy's 10th president on July 1st, resigned after only 2 months on the job, and the campus was in the throes of starting an unprecedented academic year plagued by the pandemic, and it was cleaning up from the August 10th derecho. The campus has given few details about why Beatty resigned so abruptly. Tim Laurent, the school's provost and vice president for academic affairs, has been serving as its interim president while the campus undertook a national search for a permanent replacement. At Georgetown, the nation's oldest Catholic and Jesuit university, Olson led 15 departments and 140 staffers. He's been an adjunct faculty member over his 35-year higher education career, most recently teaching in the Higher Education and Administration Program and School of Nursing and Health Studies at Georgetown. From Minnesota, Olson earned a bachelor's degree from the University of Minnesota Morris and a master's degree in counseling psychology at the University of Kansas. He earned a doctorate in higher education from the University of Denver, where he stayed to work and start the Pioneer Leadership Program, a signature academic and residential learning program. Olson spent a decade as a member of the policy committee for the Patriot League Athletic Conference and helped create the Healy Family Student Center and Georgetown's new residential facilities. He's been active in making alcohol, sexual assault, and bias reporting policy revisions at Georgetown. He and his wife, Regina, have 3 children. Speaking to Mount Mercy's Catholic Mission, Olson recently wrote a book chapter on dealing with controversial speakers and events in a Catholic context. I am enthused about the opportunity to provide leadership at this wonderful university, Olson said in a statement. Mount Mercy's deep commitment to students, vibrant academic programs, and Catholic and Mercy mission are all inspiring to me. I see tremendous strength and tremendous promise at Mount Mercy, and I look forward to working with everyone at the university to live out this mission in the years ahead. UI hospital workers gain class action status in a lawsuit over unfair pay practices. A federal judge has certified as class action a lawsuit filed 2 years ago by a group of University of Iowa hospitals and clinics employees, including nurses and custodians, accusing their employer of, among other things, failing to pay wages and overtime on time. U.S. District Court Judge Stephanie Rose certified 2 classes in her ruling this week on the lawsuit originally filed against Iowa's Board of Regents, which governs the University of Iowa and UIHC, in August of 2019. She previously certified a 3rd class of employees asserting UIHC had failed to pay their overtime by their next regular payday. This week, Rose certified class status for union members like nurses who have worked for UIHC since August 19th of 2017 and blue-collar workers like custodians who've worked there since August 7th of 2017, who have not received wages until more than 12 days after the end of their pay period. Union and blue-collar workers who've worked for UIHC since October 7th, 2017, and have since been terminated and have not received accrued vacation pay or up to $2,000 unused accumulated sick leave for retired employees age 55 and older by what would have been their next regular payday. Attorneys representing current and former UIHC employees suing the board expect the class action statuses will cover more than 8,000 workers. Employees covered under the class definitions must opt out to be excluded from the lawsuit, and attorneys are planning to send a notice giving employees that option. UIHC officials said they can't comment on pending litigation, but confirmed the organization did make payroll changes in the past year to better align UIHC's pay practices with other healthcare providers nationally. In the original lawsuit, workers accused UIHC of maintaining a policy of not paying adjustments in the pay period when they're earned or within 12 days, as required by Iowa law. Instead, these healthcare workers are routinely not paid their wage adjustments until 1 or 2 months after the period in which they were earned, according to the lawsuit. The August 2019 lawsuit came after the Gazette weeks earlier reported UIHC worker concerns with how they're paid for working extra shifts. At the time, although UIHC nurses and other providers earned a salary on a monthly basis, they operated as hourly employees capable of earning pay adjustments by working extra hours, overnights, weekends, or longer shifts. After the state stripped collective bargaining rights in 2017, unionized UIHC workers lost much of their negotiated contract and power, and the hospital also changed when and how it paid employee adjustments. The lawsuit and pay dispute came before COVID-19, which compounded UIHC's need for overtime and staff willing to work extra shifts. Last summer, facing dire pandemic-propelled losses, UIHC enacted administrative pay cuts and furloughs or returned vacation hours for unionized staffers. If, however, UIHC beats its budget this fiscal year and achieves a target margin of 3%, each staffer will get a bonus equal to 1% of his or her annual base pay. Marion Council votes to hear more about traffic cameras. While the Marion City Council on Thursday unanimously directed staff to draft an ordinance to regulate automated traffic cameras in the city, some council members are less than enthused by the idea. "My initial reaction is I'm not in favor of it," Mayor Nick Abouassili said, "but I'm always willing to be convinced. I think we need to take it slowly and carefully." Marion Police Chief Mike Kitzmiller presented the council with the camera idea during a Tuesday night work session, also attended by a representative from Census Gatso, the company that installed the automated traffic cameras in Cedar Rapids. "I think it's a good program," Kitzmiller told the council then, saying he'd recommend putting them at 6 problematic and heavily traveled intersections. "I'm not looking to blanket the entire city with cameras, but there are certain areas that could use them," he said. Kitzmiller listed the problem intersections as Highway 151 and its intersection with Highway 13, Linview Avenue, and Eagle View Drive, Highway 100 and its intersections with East Post Road and Menards Lane, and 7th Avenue and 31st Street. As it happened, one person was hospitalized Thursday before the council meeting after a car semi-trailer truck crash on Highway 100 and East Post Road. Kitzmiller also proposed the council consider buying a mobile speed camera that could be deployed to residential and commercial areas where citizens complain about speeding. "I think mobile units are great, but I'm completely opposed to the installation of cameras," Councilmember Renee Gadella said Thursday night. "The reasons for this coming forward, accident reduction, revenue generation, and saving police time, those are all great arguments, but to me, at a higher level, it's more important to protect privacy and due process," she said. The mayor said he hopes any decision on the cameras is not motivated by any potential revenue stream. "People are going to perceive it that way," he said. "You can say all day long it's not about revenue. People will still say it's about revenue." Councilmember Steve Jansen voiced concern about the level of priority for drafting such an ordinance. For the city attorney, there are more complex items on her plate, he said. This should be a lower priority. City manager Lon Plukon suggested he could provide council members with ordinances from other communities that already have automated traffic enforcement programs, like Cedar Rapids, Des Moines, and Waterloo. Looking at the differences between them might help without legal going through all the process, Plukon said. Only three Marion residents submitted comments before the meeting about the issue, all opposed. Trombino exits Iowa Homeland Security 4 months after taking over the helm. Paul Trombino has resigned as director of the Iowa Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management 4 months after taking the job. Governor Kim Reynolds said Thursday she had accepted Trombino's resignation, effective June 3rd, as Trombino leaves to pursue other opportunities. From devastating floods in 2019 to the 2020 global pandemic, Paul has worked around the clock to coordinate Iowa's emergency response, Reynolds said in a prepared statement. I appreciate his willingness to challenge the status quo to improve efficiency and functionality in state government. I am excited for him as he pursues his next opportunity. As an interim director will be named at a later date. Trombino, an engineer by training, started as Iowa Department of Transportation Director from 2011 to 2016 under Governor Terry Branstad, Reynolds' predecessor. In January 2019, Reynolds brought Trombino back to state government as her Chief Operations Officer. In his position, Trombino coordinated, among other things, the state's $50 million contract with Workday, a California software company. Lawmakers criticized the deal for sidestepping traditional competitive bidding. As the COVID-19 pandemic hit Iowa in March of 2020, Trombino also was Reynolds' point person with the no-bid $26 million Test Iowa initiative, and officials from the Iowa Department of Public Health and the State Hygienic Laboratory had to route questions and requests about the deal through Trombino. As Homeland Security Director, a position that does not require Iowa Senate confirmation, Trombino presided over federal funding to the state because of disaster declarations in 37 counties after the August 10, 2020 derecho. When Reynolds named Trombino to the post earlier this year, she gave him a $46,176 retention bonus for his continued dedication and willingness to serve the people of Iowa. This took his annual salary to more than $158,000. Over the state-mandated salary cap of $112,070 for his position. Trombino was one of five agency heads who got retention bonuses totaling more than $220,000 this year. Linn County buildings will reopen to the public beginning on June 7th. Linn County buildings will open to the public next month after being closed since last fall when COVID-19 cases began to spike in the area. County facilities will reopen on June 7th, according to a county news release. Masks will still are required in all county buildings, though that is subject to change before the opening date, the release said. Social distancing and other safety protocols will be in place. These buildings are affected. The Gene Oxley Linn County Public Service Center, this community services building at 1240 26th Avenue Court Southwest, the Department of Human Services, a state-run building located in this county building, will open at a later date. The Dr. Percy and Lilia Harris building, Juvenile Detention and Diversion Services, Secondary Road Department, and the Linn County Sheriff's Office, LIFS, Linn County Courthouse, Juvenile Justice Center, and the Wikiapil Learning Center. In addition, County Park Conservation Lodge rentals and reservations will resume. Linn County will continue to offer services over the phone and online, including building permit applications, title transfers, and online vehicle registration renewals, the release said. Drop boxes will remain in place for residents to submit payments, vehicle registration renewals, or any other paperwork. Residents who already submitted paperwork to the treasurer's office do not need to visit or call the office, as transactions already in progress will be completed, according to the release. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, May 21st, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Joseph Joe Lynn Balvin Sr., age 63, of Elberon, Iowa, passed away Tuesday, May 18th at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. Joe was born on September 26, 1957, the son of Leonard and Florence Callanay Balvin. He attended St. Joseph Catholic School and continued his education with South Tama High School, where he graduated the class of 1976. He was a lifelong member of St. Joseph Catholic Church in Chelsea, Iowa. Following school, he began driving truck for his father-in-law. He would later own his own truck, Joe Balvin Trucking, which he operated for many years before selling his truck. He later worked for Inroads Paving, where he continued to work until just recently. On September 27, 1980, he was married to Colleen Kuchanik at St. Joseph Catholic Church. Together, they lived in Elberon, where they raised their daughter and son. Mass of Christian burial is 10 a.m. Tuesday, May 25th at St. Michael's Catholic Church in Belle Plaine, with Father Greg Ball and Deacon Joe Bohonek officiating. Burial will take place at St. Joseph Cemetery in Chelsea. Visitation is 4 to 7 p.m. with rosary at 6:30 p.m. on Monday, May 24th at Hraybeck New House Funeral Service in Belle Plaine. Memorials may be made to the family. Janet K. Murray Swanka Brandt, age 82, finished her journey here on Earth on May 16, 2021. She passed away at Stony Brook Assisted Living Center in West Union. Janet was born January 23, 1939, to Doris Anna Jenks Murray and Edwin Leland Murray at home in Manila, Iowa. On August 3, 1978, Janet married Milton Mike M.L. Brandt in Owine. Funeral services will be held at the Fayette Community Church in Fayette at a later date. Janet will be cremated and her remains buried in the Nishnabotna Cemetery outside Manila, Iowa at a later date. Jimmy L. Divvy Shroop, age 66, of rural Oxford, died Tuesday, May 18th at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Funeral services will be held at 3 p.m. Saturday, May 22nd at the St. Mary's Auditorium in Oxford, where there will be a time of visitation from 1 p.m. until services on Saturday. Burial will be held at the Graben Cemetery in rural Oxford. In lieu of flowers, a memorial fund has been established in Jim's memory. For a complete obituary or to share a thought, memory, or condolence, please visit the funeral home website at gayandsheha.com. Patricia Ann Hepker Hopper, age 76, passed away on Wednesday, May 19, 2021, at her home. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. on Monday, May 24th, at the First Christian Church in Vinton, with the Reverend Dick Jumper officiating. Interment will be held at a later date at Maplewood Cemetery in Vinton. Friends may call from 9:30 until service time on Monday at the church. Masks will be at the attendees' discretion. Pat was born on April 5, 1945, in Urbana, the daughter of Clifford and Leela Boyles Hepker. On June 24, 1962, she was united in marriage to Jack Hopper at the Urbana Methodist Church. Pat was a loving mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother. She enjoyed card clubs, trout fishing, and especially enjoyed her grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Freeman Frederick Harry Kaufman, age 96, of Wilton, Iowa, passed away Wednesday, May 19th at Pinnacle Elder Group Homes in Muscatine. A visitation will be held from 10 to 1 Saturday, May 22nd at Bentley Funeral Home in Wilton. A funeral service will be held at 1 p.m. Saturday, May 22nd at Bentley Funeral Home in Wilton. A burial with military rites will take place in Oakdale Cemetery in Wilton. Memorials may be given to the Wilton Ambulance Fund. Freeman was born on October 28, 1924, the son of Harry and Martha Kaufman in Cedar County. He attended the Sharon and Lime City County Schools and graduated from Wilton High School with the class of 1941. Freeman proudly served his country in the United States Army during World War II. Freeman married Ruby Whitmer on February 24, 1945, in Killeen, Texas. Ruby passed away on December 7, 2008. Freeman farmed for more than 60 years on the family farms in rural Cedar County. Farming was his life, and he would often work 12-plus-hour days into his late 80s. He was a member of the First Presbyterian Church in Wilton and the Durant American Legion. Freeman enjoyed traveling and wintering in the South with his wife, Ruby. He was also an avid shuffleboard player and water skier. Freeman will be dearly missed by 3 sons, 10 grandchildren, and 16 great-grandchildren. Irene Betty Konechny passed away peacefully on Saturday, November 28, 2020. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, her celebration of life was postponed. It will now take place on Sunday, May 23rd, from 2 to 4 p.m. at the ITC Pavilion at Knollbridge City Park in Cedar Rapids. Please bring along a picture or special memory to share as we celebrate the life of this special lady who loves coming here to enjoy the beautiful flowers each year. Attendees are asked to adhere to current mask and social distancing guidelines in place at the time of the event. Let's turn to some more news now, and this is sports coverage from the girls' state track and field. This wasn't your ordinary run-of-the-mill competitor that Audrey Bierman ran down. It was Ainsley Erzin of Carlisle, a double winner at the Drake Relays. "I definitely felt a little pressure," Bierman said. "She's a really good runner." But Bierman is a superior kicker, and when it became a kicker's race, Bierman pounced. A junior from Western Dubuque, Bierman raced past Erzin at the end, winning the Class 3A girls 400-meter dash at the state track and field meet Thursday at Drake Stadium. Bierman was clocked in at 55.8 seconds. Erzin, the Drake champion in the 400 and 800, finished in 56.21. "I'm so excited," Bierman said. "I'm speechless. I saw her coming on the inside of me, but I really wanted it. I had to dig down and kick really hard." Bierman already had 2 races under her belt, a preliminary in the 100 and one in the 200. She'll take the top time in both events into Saturday's finals. Ignited by a 1-4 finish in the 3,000 meters, Ballard is the first day leader in the 3A team race. The Bombers have 19 points through 5 events. Charles City is second with 16 points, followed by Oskaloosa with 13, Dubuque-Wallert with 12, and Western Dubuque also with 12. Solon has 10 points thanks to a breathtaking effort in the 3,200-meter relay. Kaya Holtkamp, Anna Killen, Grace Federspile, and Emma Bach carried the baton in 9:21.84, beating the field by more than 13 seconds. "That's crazy," Bach said. "Definitely not expected." Federspile broke the race open with a carry of 2:18, then Bach closed it with another 2:18 split. "I knew I had to go fast," Federspile said. "I just kept going. 9:21, that's unbelievable. It's shocking." Bach said, "I knew Grace was going to get us the lead. She's that competitive." In college golf, Kirkwood drops Morgan in second. Kirkwood dropped 1 spot to 5th after the 3rd round of the NJCAA Division II Championships on Thursday at the Swan Lake Resort Black Course in Plymouth, Indiana. After shooting 293 and 294 the first 2 rounds, the Eagles turned in a 315 Thursday. James Morgan remains in contention individually after carding a 2-over-74. He is tied for second. In baseball, Beloit scored 3 runs in the top of the 9th inning, 2 on a home run by Will Banfield, to top Cedar Rapids 4-2 at Veterans Memorial Stadium. Also Thursday, pitcher Jonathan Chesmer was promoted to the AAA St. Paul Saints, and outfielder Deshaun Kearsley Jr. was placed on the 7-day injured list with a left hamstring strain. College basketball, the Iowa State is going to NIT in Brooklyn. Iowa State will play in the 2021 NIT season tip-off on November 24th and November 26th at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, New York. The event also includes Memphis, Virginia Tech, and Xavier. College track, Iowa Director of Track and Field Joey Woody was named the Big Ten Men's Track and Field Coach of the Year on Thursday. Also, junior Jamal Britt was named to the Big Ten Athlete of the Championships. Britt won the 400 hurdles and was runner-up in the 110 hurdles and long jump. In the NBA playoffs, Russell Westbrook and Bradley Beal did what they do, a near triple-double for one, 25 points in just 29 minutes for the other, and the Washington Wizards reached the NBA playoffs as the Eastern Conference's number 8 seed by overwhelming the Indiana Pacers 114-115 in the play-in round last night. Washington advanced to face the number 1 seed Philadelphia 76ers in the first round. Also from state track and field, Washington's Morris captures the 3A 400 title. As a sophomore whose first high school track and field season was a COVID-19 casualty, Washington's Elijah Morris was a preseason mystery. "I was going to be an 800 guy," he said, "but teammate Lance Sebaski has me there. That shot me down to the 400. I'm okay with that now. You can't call Morris an unknown any longer. Just a state champion." He raced to glory in the Class 3A 400 meter dash Thursday afternoon at Drake Stadium in 49.53 seconds. "It's really cool," he said. "Hopefully I can pull a couple more of these off." Morris got out well and maintained a slim margin throughout the race, winning by 12 hundredths of a second. "The first 100, I was a little stiff," he said. "I took a breath and got going. I'm in pain. My muscles don't like the 400. Pella is the 3A boys team leader through five events with 21.5 points. Adele ADM is second with 20, followed by North Polk at 18 and Washington with 16. The 3200-meter relay had a back-burner event for Clear Creek Manor through much of the season. "It really hadn't been a primary focus," Tom Johnson said. "It was just something we threw together for points. They spotlighted it Thursday, and the result was a third-place finish." Gavin Zilliet, Cash Jensen, Brandon Barker, and Johnson ran a school record 7 minutes, 59.62 seconds. "We thought maybe we could break a school record, 8.05, but this caught all of us by surprise," said Zilliet, who opened in 1:57. Zilliet's opening carry put CCA into the lead. Then the Clippers ran second and third the rest of the way. Pella won the race in 7:55.14. Then star anchor Nate Muller's 1:52.5 split pushed Adele ADM past Clear Creek Amanda for second. "I can truly say that Muller is one guy I don't mind getting chased down by," Johnson said. Ethan Patterson of Washington and Caden Unz of Monticello were third and fourth in the high jump. In Class 1A and 2A, a rain-soaked approach and a slick board were no problem for Lisbon's Cole Becker on Thursday at the Class 1A state track and field meet. Becker won at the long jump title at Drake Stadium with a winning leap of 22 feet 4 inches. "I'm not sure how I was able to do that in these conditions," Becker said. "I just went out there and hoped for the best." Becker had the title locked up before his final jump, which was the 22.4. Before that jump, his leading distance was 21.8.25 inches. His personal record is 22.8, so he didn't quite set a PR, but getting over 22 feet with sheets of rain falling from the sky was nothing to scoff at. "You want to give it everything and see where you can get," Becker said of his mindset before his last jump. "You already got all the adrenaline, and then with the crowd, you want to see what you can do." The crowd is something Becker appreciated having. Just a few days before the championship started, they were supposed to be limited fans, and last year the championships didn't happen at all. "It was great having a crowd there because crowds can do so much for you," Becker said. "I couldn't try to win it last year, so it feels good to get a title this year." Becker's win has Lisbon sitting in sixth place in the 1A boys team race with 10 team points. Madrid leaves with 27 points. Jessup's Carson Leno won the shot putt with a throw of 55 feet and a half inch. "I can't believe it," Leno said. "I just wanted to come out here and compete for a top three finish. Once I came out and my first one was a 53-footer, I knew it was going to be a pretty special day." Leno said the 55-footer was the best technical throw of his life, and with the added adrenaline, it all came together for him. "It was the surrealest moment I've ever felt in any sport," Leno said, of stepping into the circle for his last throw, knowing he had already won. "That was absolutely awesome." His win had Jessup tied with four other schools for fourth place after day one. Tipton is in second place in the team race. The Tigers didn't have any first place finishers, but they had a number of point scorers. Tipton's Niall Schuett finished third in the shot put with a best throw of 49 feet 9 and a quarter inches. Caleb Shoemaker finished second in the 3200 meter run with a time of 9:27.38 behind Bellevue's Brady Grebel at 9:22.83. Eight laps. I knew we were going to be there together, Schumacher said. Griebel took it out faster than I expected. And Tipton's 32-meter relay team, anchored by Schumacher, finished second with a time of 8:15.82, just behind Northeast at 8:15.69. In Class 4A, Liberty reigns in the 3200 relay. He checked the video board, he rounded the last curve, he cracked a grin. It was such a good feeling, Iowa City Liberty's Bo Grip said. I knew we had it. They had it, all right. Gavin Keeney, Jack Kinzer, Caleb Schillinger, and Grip raced to the Class 4A boys' 3200-meter relay title Thursday afternoon at the state track and field meet at Drake Stadium. Their time, 7 minutes, 49.45 seconds. That's motoring, and that's grinworthy. Cedar Falls has been ahead of us all year, Kinzer said. That definitely motivated us. I thought we could beat them. And 750 has been our goal all year long. This puts us among some of the best all time. Liberty was in control of the race virtually the whole way, and as Grip rounded the final curve, he checked the video board one last time for challengers. There wasn't anybody in close proximity, and Liberty finished about 3 seconds ahead of runner-up Ames. Cedar Falls accumulated 28 points in Thursday's five events and leads the 4A boys team race. Ames is second with 23.5 points, followed by West Des Moines Dowling at 21 and Linmar at 16. Linmar got a title out of McCade Jelinek in the discus. Jelinek took the lead early with a 175-foot fling, then with victory secure, flung it 178-11. I came in thinking the conditions were going to be tough, Jelinek said, referring to the on-and-off rain. I slowed my spin a little. Then once I got comfortable, I sped it up again. I tried to keep the disc as dry as I could. It wasn't Jelinek's first competition in crummy conditions. My freshman year at Iowa City West, the ring was flooded, he said. We had a scrimmage this year at Clear Creek Amana, and it was wet there. Linmar scored all 16 of its points Thursday in the field events. TJ Jackson was third in the high jump, clearing 6-4. I slipped a lot late in my jumps, but I can't make excuses. Everybody else was jumping in the same conditions, Jackson said. I felt like I forgot everything I was taught. I just didn't perform well today. College softball news now, and Northern Iowa and Iowa State softball are set to compete in an NCAA regional for the first time since 2013 and 1988, respectively, this afternoon. The head-scratching comes from the NCAA Tournament Committee pitching the two state rivals against one another in the first game of the Columbia-Missouri Regional. Today's 1 p.m. matchup, which will be televised on ESPN3, will be the third between the two rivals this season. On February 12th at the Unidome Classic, Iowa State routed the Panthers 12-2. 2 months later, on April 14th, UNI, with a 20-7 record in the Missouri Valley Conference, even the season series with a 10-2 win in Cedar Falls at Robinson Dresser Sports Complex. Entering today's regional with a roster that has no NCAA tournament experience, UNI coach Ryan Jacobs believes the familiarity with the Cyclones, which have a 6-12 record in the Big 12, will help calm his team's nerves. The way the team has prepared the last half of the season on their own, and now knowing that they've actually seen Iowa State with their own eyes, it's not a video thing. I think that adds a little bit of an element of being comfortable, Jacobs said. Doesn't mean it's going to be easier, because Iowa State is a great team. But the fact that we know their players, we've seen them, we've played against them, definitely helps the nerve factor going into that first game. The familiarity between the two teams is an advantage for both, however. The Panthers hold a one-sided advantage as their ace, Kalen Packard, did not appear in either of the two regular season matchups. Packard, a transfer from UMKC, gave UNI the boost it needed this season. The sophomore recorded a career-best 1.62 ERA and was the Missouri Valley Conference's Pitcher of the Year. I would just say sticking to my game plan, staying with my strength instead of looking for their weaknesses, Packard said of her approach against ISU. UNI enters today's matchup after having received its first at-large bid in program history. The Panthers fell short in the MVC Tournament Championship, 2-0 to Southern Illinois, and Jacobs said his team was eager to get back to practice this week. I even gave the team the option on Sunday night, what do you guys want to do this week for practice? And they were all about practicing, Jacobs said. I even had to fight for a day off for them for one day because I think they would have practiced every single day. So I think the mindset is there. Business news now, and a new report says that 64% of millennials regret purchasing a home. In today's highly competitive real estate market, it's all too common for buyers to rush into a deal that doesn't fit their budget or suit their needs. Millennials, in particular, have the most regrets after buying a home, according to a new Bankrate survey. Buyers' regrets are even more of a factor in the pandemic, with sight unseen offers and contingencies waived to win the bid. The survey highlights some of the most common regrets new homeowners have and which demographic groups are most likely to have them. That desperation to land a home leads some buyers to settle for properties that aren't quite right for them. Home buyer regrets broadly fell into two major categories, financial and physical. In general, the survey found the older the buyer, the less likely they were to have misgivings about their purchase after the fact. In all, 64% of millennial homebuyers, those ages 25 to 40, have some regrets about their purchase compared with just 33% of baby boomer buyers ages 57 to 75. Mortgage rates are still pushing higher. The 30-year fixed rate rises to 3%. Mortgage rates moved higher this week as worries about inflation and potential moves by the Federal Reserve unsettled investors. According to the latest data released Thursday by Freddie Mac, the 30-year fixed rate average climbed to 3%, with an average 0.6 point. Points are fees paid to a lender equal to 1% of the loan amount. They are in addition to the interest rate. It was 2.94% a week ago and 3.2% a year ago. Freddie Mac, the federally chartered mortgage investor, aggregates rates from around 80 lenders across the country to come up with a weekly national average. It uses rates for high-quality borrowers with strong credit scores and large down payments. Because of the criteria, these rates are not available to every borrower. The survey is based on home purchase mortgages, which means rates for refinances may be higher. The price adjustment for refinance transactions that went into effect in December is adding to the cost. The adjustment, which applies to all Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac refinances, is 0.5% of the loan amount. That works out to $1,500 on a $300,000 loan. The 15-year fixed rate average rose to 2.29% with an average 0.7 point. It was 2.26% a week ago and 2.7% a year ago. The 5-year adjustable rate average was unchanged at 2.59% with an average 0.3 point. It was 3.17% a year ago. Stocks end higher on Wall Street. Technology companies led broad gains for stocks on Wall Street Thursday, ending a 3-day losing streak for the major U.S. indexes. Investors were encouraged by the latest jobs data that showed fewer Americans filing for unemployment benefits, another sign that the economic recovery is underway. The S&P 500 gained 1.1%. Tech and communication stocks accounted for much of the market rally, with Apple rising 2.1%, and Google's parent Alphabet rising 1.6%. The sector remains the biggest gainer so far this year with a 36% gain. Several retailers were among the biggest decliners in the S&P 500. Gap dropped 1.4%, while L Brands, owner of Victoria's Secret, skidded 2.6%. Ross Stores lost 2.7%. Investors continue to be focused on the potential for inflation down the road, with prices for everything from gasoline to lumber rising sharply this year as the economy reheats after the pandemic. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, May 21st, 2021. I'm your reader, Lee Dwyer. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thank you for listening.